So welcome again, everybody. I'd like to begin this evening by, as I said, taking time for some questions or some sharing. You know, it could be some sharing about how this meditation was for you today or any other of the readings or the teachings or the practices we've been doing over these recent weeks. And we have, you know, a certain amount of time, maybe 20 minutes or as much as we need. And then I'll talk about this third of the Brahmaviharas, the teachings and practices of mudita, or appreciative joy. Do we have a mic, Glenn? Or, no, we just do. Okay. So if you would speak nice and loud so we can all hear. Yes, please, Carol.
Last week I expressed to you my discomfort around the week and asked you to clarify what could be considered wholesome grief.
Yeah.
Versus.
Yeah. So the question Carol brought up after class last week was about grief and your perception that it felt like I was saying that it was kind of a negative thing to be overwhelmed. And I think I'm glad to have the chance to clarify that. I think it's not a helpful thing to be so overwhelmed that we're kind of immobilized by grief or by any other quality. But it is natural that when we suffer a loss, that we will feel sadness, we will feel grief, we'll go through the stages of grieving. And part of that may be feeling overwhelmed, like we've been washed over by it. And I wouldn't want in any way to say that that's, you know, the inappropriate or, you know, the wrong response or anything, because it's not about what's the right or wrong response. But what I'm really looking at is, you know, how can we cultivate responses that will help us wake up, help us open as fully as we can to our experience. And hopefully we want to get to the place where we fully experience the grieving and the sadness and everything else that goes with it. But it doesn't force us into a place of contraction where we're really resisting the experience because it's overwhelming. We want to be able to open to it. And, you know, that may include being overwhelmed by it and coming out, you know, it's like a wave coming over us and then washing over us and then coming back and breathing again. And coming back into the world, you know, in a way that allows us to have fully experienced and fully open to it. But what isn't so helpful is if we live in that place of contraction or where we're not fully opening to it. And that may be partly because it's too overwhelming, we can't open to it. So then we try and find ways in which, you know, we perhaps more gradually can open, you know, step by step, to feeling what at first may feel too much to hold. So that's really what I'm talking about. Does that kind of speak to your question, Carol?
Because we talked about the extremes of shutting down and not letting it in, and then wearing it like a cloak.
Yeah.
Where your grief covers everything.
Yeah.
So there's this middle path.
Yeah. So there's, yeah, as you're saying, a middle path. You know, I think we talked about, you know, we can wallow in our grief. You know, and then what we're doing is we're not really opening to the experience. We're really being in a story about it. Oh, poor me, isn't it terrible? All these things I have to put up with. That really is the story. It's not opening to it. It's really being lost in a story. So being able to see when we're in a story and kind of let the story be, you know, it comes and it goes, but not let that be the place where we're living, you know, let that come and go, and then open as fully and as wholly and as genuinely as we can to the experience itself. So I think that was a really helpful distinction. Thank you, Carol. Thank you.
I just wanted to make one follow-up comment to that or a question. You're talking about opening to whatever it is, you know, like whatever it is. And I'm just wondering, like, I feel like a lot of people want to have control of situations. Like, one friend of mine was writing me earlier today, and you know, he's talking about, he's really going through something, and he's talking about how, like, he feels like he's at the bottom of a pit, like something to do with sabotage. Oh, there. He feels like he's in the bottom of a pit and everyone's kicking him down or something like that. And I was trying to, like, say whatever I could to be helpful. I was like, oh, well, what leads you to feel that way? But I mean, you know, so I guess if the idea in that situation, to apply what you said to that situation, I mean, obviously it maybe has some kind of distorted thinking or whatever. I mean, I'm sure it's very complicated. But if we're going to be open to whatever it is going on, I feel like people want to be in control of the situation. Like, if he feels, like, out of control or, like, people are, you know, putting him down or making him feel bad or something, then, I mean, it's not necessarily something positive if it's just tearing him up. So I don't know how to apply that to that situation exactly. Or, I mean, I don't know. Maybe it's talking about something different.
Where does the question of control come in, you know, and really it's as we were talking about before in relation to kind of being overwhelmed by grief. It's being in a place where I think where we're not. It's not a form of control where we're kind of tightly holding on, you know, and there's this sense of like I've got to get somewhere, you know, and. But it's also not on the other side of kind of just collapsing and, you know, oh, you know, I can't do anything. Because both of those are kind of really are being caught in stories. So one is a story of like, I've got to be in control of this and I've got to, you know, get something done, or I can't do anything is the other story. I'm kind of like, oh, I'll let them walk all over me or whatever the story is. So finding a place where we're genuinely opening to what is, you know, which may be a very painful place, it may be difficult. We may have come to a place in our lives where, you know, things are very hard, you know, financially or health-wise or relationship. And it's like in, you know, in the 12-step program of kind of taking a, you know, a, an inventory of really being honest about where things are, of acknowledging that, like, this is the truth of where I am right now. And from that place of truth, we can then, you know, we can say we can take control, we can kind of move our intentions and our actions in ways that will serve freedom, that will serve happiness, that will help us to be alive, that it will help us to make choices that are helpful for us, that will serve us. So it's finding that place. It is genuinely being with what is, but not with a story of, oh, you know, I'm being with what is and nothing's going to change, you know, or being with what is being passive. Oh, I can't do anything. Because that, again, that's a story. Being with what is acknowledging that this is the truth of how things are right now. And how can I be with that and take wise action or speak wisely or live wisely, you know? So it's finding that place, and it's wisdom and discernment that will tell us, that comes from genuinely being with what is and being compassionate with ourselves, you know, opening. That's why these practices are so, so important, you know, that the practices of mindfulness, obviously, of acknowledging this is what is, but these practices of cultivating the heart that allow us to hold what is and allow us to hold others in our hearts, even when at times they may be acting in ways that, you know, may not be very skillful and that may be, you know, may be harmful, that we don't push them out of our hearts, that we, you know, that we hold them in our hearts, so. Anyone? Let me ask a question or two. How have you found these practices, doing loving kindness practice or compassion practice? You know, for some, you know, may I be filled with loving kindness kind of feels didn't resonate for one or two people. Are there particular words and phrases that work for you? Do the words and phrases work for you at all? Do you find it more difficult? We talked about this in an earlier class of like, is it more difficult to bring loving kindness to yourself than to others? Was it difficult to bring loving kindness to a difficult person in your life, or was that an easy practice? You know, so what's coming up for you? Does visualizing help for you? You know, what is it that you find works, if anything, in this practice? Anything anyone would like to share? It doesn't have to be a question. It just can be just your own experience.
This is it's a little bit related to what you're posing, but actually a practice that we were doing just today. So if we are trying to open to an internal felt sense, for example, if I pose, you know, what is between me and experiencing joy? And then there's sort of a thought that comes up, well, your work is not the most engaging, or something like that. And the thought's just hanging out there. The question is, you know, do I have to stop it, just kind of parroting that back and leave it there? Or can I sort of try to extend a little bit further and sort of, you know, well, I can't get new work at this moment, you know. So is it possible to open to joy right now in this moment, all things being as they are? The question is, you know, can we kind of continue that, to try to open with intuition that way, or do we have to just sort of take the first thing that comes back?
If I'm understanding your question, what comes up, what came up, or what might come up is in the invitation to see what's in the way, thought about, oh, my work could be more engaging than it is. So that comes up as an obstacle in the moment of like, oh, I could feel joy if only my work were more engaging. And one thing you might do is to just experience that thought arising, you know, that feels like it's an obstacle in this moment. And then notice that's a thought, that, okay, it's a thought about work being more engaged, you know, might be more engaging. But I think as you're pointing to, is that really in the way right now of this moment? You know, that's something that's over there somewhere else. It's past, it's future. You know, it's only here right now insofar as it's a bubble comes up and says, oh, my work could be more interesting than it is. So is it really an obstacle? You know, yes, it comes up as an obstacle, but is it really genuinely an obstacle? You know, it could be a thought. It could be any thought, couldn't it? It could be, you know, I'm worried that X might win the election in November. You know, that might come up as a thought, you know, whoever it might be for you, whoever the candidate that you don't want to have win the election comes up. And, you know, but again, right now, is that really a problem? You know, it's interesting how we could be, and often perhaps are, in situations of great beauty, great wonder, you know, is seemingly of great ease. You know, the sun is shining, we're on a beach, or we're walking in nature, and, you know, you'd think, well, this is wonderful, and yet the mind can be in hell. You know, we can be caught up in, oh, all this stuff I've got to do, and, oh, they're making it so difficult for me at work. You know, they're conspiring against me, or, you know, oh, my relationship is in such turmoil. You know, so we're not really even where we are. So at that moment, what's getting in the way is our thought or our belief about a situation that is not really present right now. It's only present in our minds. So the invitation is just to notice that, okay, right now that's coming as, you know, coming up as, it really is affecting me. I'm tight, I'm I'm caught up in contraction, even though I'm in this beautiful natural situation. So just to be able to see that that's a thought, that it's coming and going, kind of notice it, and then to invite ourselves back into this moment. Right now, what am I aware of? Can I feel my body walking down this path? Can I feel myself breathing in this spring air? Can I feel the sun on my face? Because while I'm caught up in that story, I'm not aware of any of those things. So once I'm back and I'm really feeling the sun on my face, feeling myself walking, hearing the sound of the bird or whatever it is, then I'm back here in the present moment. I'm not there in my thoughts about the election or my thoughts about my work or my thoughts about my relationship. I'm back here right now. Now, very easily, my thoughts, I might, you know, hear the bird, I might feel the sun, I might feel my body on the ground, but then my thoughts go, you know, back into contraction again. But then I can just notice that. That's what mindfulness allows us to do, to see, oh, got tight again. Okay, notice that. Can I come back to the sun on my face? Can I come back to the in-breath and the out-breath? Can I come back to the sounds of the birds or the traffic? So that even though in this moment it feels like there's an obstacle, is it really an obstacle if I open to this moment as it is, you know? And I think the more we explore this, the more we see the obstacles are just creations of the mind. And they don't have to really get in the way. It's not to say they don't come up to us as real. You know, if something really, you know, we get a really serious health diagnosis, it's not that suddenly we're going to come, you know, be able to say, oh, a thought, worry about health, you know, or you know, our relationship is going through a really difficult period. And then we say, oh, relationship difficulty, you know. I mean, we can do that, but the mind will tend to get into that really contracted space. But whatever it is, we have that opportunity of just seeing, okay, right now, yes, this is hard. We can acknowledge, yeah, this is difficult. And it's a difficult period I'm going through right now. The acknowledging of that, the self-compassion, will give us the space to be able to help us come back into this moment and feel, okay, can I just be here right now? Can I just... You know, and we can do it. We know we can do it. We know people who can do it. We also know it's not easy because those places of fear and contraction are very strong. So that's why it's a practice and it takes time. And it takes this kind of moment to moment coming back. Okay, right now, can I come back? Can I feel the sadness? Can I feel the waves of sadness? And come out of the story of the sadness or the story of what's going on into the direct experience of it. And that's a very different thing. It's not that it's easy to feel the waves of the sadness, for example, or the waves of the fear going through us, but it's a very different story, a very different experience than being in the contraction that is the armoring that we're putting around the experience itself. And that really is the difference. We're inviting ourselves back into the direct experience. Anyone else? Any thoughts? Maybe one, two more, if anything. Has it been helpful for you to do the meditations, to do the practices outside, you know, daily or as often as you can? Anything? Yeah, please.
On Thursday, I went to work kind of nonchalantly around 2:30, thinking that I was starting at 3, and my secretary said, hello, how are you? I said, fine. I went in and talked to the other staff people. And then 5 minutes later, somebody came in and said, you do know you had a patient at 2:15. And I said, oh, no, I didn't know that. And I just kind of walked into the room, and I talked to the patient, and she was quite happy to be resting. And I did the whole thing. And then I said to my secretary when I got done, it threw the whole day off. I mean, the whole day I was late then. And I didn't have a reaction. I mean, I was just like, okay. And I said to my secretary, you know, we need a different system. If I'm not here 10 minutes before I'm supposed to start, you need to let me know. And that was it. And in the past, my reaction would have been really very brusque and a little bit righteous indignation and why didn't you say something? And I wouldn't have been outright angry, but everybody in the office would have known I wasn't happy. And that didn't happen. You know, it just was like, huh, You know, and I'm sure my secretary was feeling terrible that she hadn't called like she was supposed to. I didn't need to tell her that she was wrong. And I noticed a couple other places in my life where my normal knee-jerk reaction is to think somebody's doing something to me. And that just didn't happen. It was like I was more curious, I was more engaged, I was wondering what was going on as opposed to just assuming that something negative was happening to me. And I think that's this practice. I really do. I mean, it's, you know, so I'm loving the practice when I do it at home, but it's showing up in my world. Yeah, that's thrilling. Yeah.
Thank you for sharing that. That's really great just to see how the practice goes out and affects one's life. And you could say if it didn't, then it would be kind of limited in value, and that really is the essence of what, you know, the practice is that it's how we live our lives. And it's great to hear the way in which, you know, just finding that, experiencing the space which, you know, wouldn't have been there or wasn't there in the same way before, to be able to just, oh, okay, this is, you know, this is how things are, and be able to kind of accept that this is the way things are, and noticing that is wonderful, because it really it's an encouragement to, you know, to continue and deepen, I think, the practice.
Well, also, I think when I asked her what had happened before, I jumped to any conclusion, yeah. And she said, you know, I just got it in my mind that you knew when to start, and she couldn't move off of that. And I just, my natural reaction that day was like, oh, I understand, I've done that too, where you just can't open up your mind to, wait, she's not here yet, she's 15 minutes late, she's never late, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so there was this compassion for her. I mean, I had all this room for her humanness in the moment, you know, even though it threw everything off, it was just, she was just being human. And sure, I could, I don't know, it was just very different. It was very nice. I really liked myself a lot better. So.
Lovely. Lovely. Thank you. That's great. Do we take one more if somebody had a hand up? Yes, please. Lovely, thank you. That's beautiful. The natural arising of the words and phrases over these weeks as you've practiced, that when people who are in your circle are having difficulties and serious major things happening in their lives, that the phrases naturally arise and the word ease coming up just been used a lot. And that's wonderful and that's great. And I think it's the more that happens, the more it, you know, what we're doing really is we're transforming ourselves in this practice. I mean, we're cultivating an open heart, you know, a connection with others. We're bringing awareness more to the ways in which we do shut down, and not reject that, but just to see that we don't have to stay in that place, that we can open to it, let it come, let it go, and cultivate these qualities of heart that allow us to be in connection with others, not in a place of separation. So glad to hear that that's been working for you. Thank you. So let me talk a little this evening about this third of the Brahma Viharas, appreciative joy or sympathetic joy, the word mudita M-U-D-I-T-A. So this is the third of these divine abodes. And it's really experiencing happiness in the success, the well-being, the happiness of another. And ultimately, rejoicing and being happy in the happiness of everyone, everyone's happiness. So just as we spoke about metta or loving kindness being a quality of love that's not attached, that's not dependent on how close someone is to us or dependent on them acting in a particular way, not dependent on conditions. We talked about metta and we explored it as a quality of kindness, of well-wishing that arises naturally when we're not caught up in clinging or aversion. So when we're not closed down, there's a natural arising of loving kindness. And that we can consciously cultivate it. And that we really need to cultivate loving kindness because our habits and conditioning tend to lead us towards shutting down, towards contraction. And I'll talk about that tonight in relation to joy. The second of the qualities of these divine abodes, karuna or compassion, is the quality of an open heart when it meets suffering, when this loving open heart sees somebody who is suffering, what naturally arises is compassion, is caring. We spoke about it as the quivering of the heart in response to suffering. And again, it naturally arises when we're not closed down, when we're not caught up in what Tara Brach talks about as the trance of separation, the trance of separation, this kind of dreamlike quality of thinking we're this separate, isolated person, separate from everybody else and from life. And like loving kindness, we can cultivate compassion by inclining our mind towards caring about the suffering of another or of others. So the quality we'll be talking about tonight, mudita, or appreciative joy, is the quality that arises when an open, loving heart sees the happiness, the joy, the success, or the well-being of another. What naturally arises when we're not caught up again in the illusion of separation is mudita, is appreciative joy or sympathetic joy, joy in the happiness or well-being of another. And like loving kindness and like compassion, we can cultivate mudita. It arises naturally, but we can also cultivate it, and we need to cultivate it for the same reason that we easily shut down, we easily get into a place of contraction where we're feeling separate, we're not feeling joy in the happiness of another, we're more likely to be feeling schadenfreude, you know, the happiness in another's unhappiness, you know, the quality of, you know, Montaigne spoke about something, you know, the quality of being kind of happy when a friend isn't doing so well, you know, kind of more common, if you like, than appreciative joy. So I want to talk first about the importance of joy and happiness in the Buddha's teachings, because sometimes the Buddha's teachings, Buddhism, is seen as really being about suffering. You know, it's all about suffering. I remember reading something that this current Catholic Pope, Benedict XVI, said when he was a cardinal. You know, so it's probably back in the 90s, and you know, about the talking about Buddhism and, you know, having a really negative worldview and all about suffering. And I thought, well, that really is a misunderstanding of Buddhist teachings, because what Buddhism speaks about is suffering and the end of suffering. We need to be aware of suffering and its cause and the causes of suffering, which is basically the second noble truth, is that it comes from clinging. It comes from being, you know, this sense of being a separate, isolated self. But we also need to know that the third and the fourth of the Noble Truths, which are the central teachings of the Buddha, that they're about ending suffering and they're about the path to the end of suffering. So that the teachings are about suffering and the end of suffering. And the end of suffering is to live a life of happiness, of peace, of joy, of freedom, of love. And it's a happiness, a joy, that isn't dependent on conditions. It's a natural, innate freedom, innate peace, innate joy that comes with the letting go of greed, of aversion, and delusion. So joy is a central part of Buddhist practice. It's the fourth of what are called the awakening factors. These are the qualities that the Buddha said. He used a simile. He said, these qualities, just as a river inclines towards the sea, so these seven qualities incline towards nirvana, incline towards freedom. And these seven qualities, the middle one of these is joy, joy or rapture. I'll just name them. The first is mindfulness, very familiar with mindfulness. The second is investigation, the quality of really being curious and interested about our experience. The third is energy, kind of the quality that helps us move towards our objectives or our goals. The fourth is joy. Each of these builds on each other. Mindfulness helps us cultivate investigation, which helps energy develop. And as energy develops, joy tends to naturally arise. So joy is the fourth of these qualities. The other qualities are when joy kind of calms a little bit, what arises naturally is calm, tranquility, or ease. Any of these words applies to this, this fifth quality, calm, tranquility, ease. And the sixth is concentration, the mind that's really focused and one-pointed. And the seventh is equanimity, which is also one of the Brahma Viharas that we'll be looking at next week. So equanimity, this sense of being at peace, being balanced amidst the joys and the sorrows. So joy is one of these qualities that the Buddha said is really essential for waking up, essential for finding freedom. So joy is really a central part of the Buddhist practice. Is a wonderful saying of the Buddha. He said, live in joy, in love, even among those who hate. Live in joy, in health, even among the afflicted. Live in joy, in peace, even among the troubled. Look within, be still, free from fear and attachment. Know the sweet joy of the way. And the Buddha and his community of monks and nuns, the Sangha, were known as the happy ones, the happy ones. There they were, living, you know, and part of the monastic order, the monastic discipline is not to own anything except, you know, your robes, your bowl, your medication. And yet, these many, many hundreds of monastics were known as being joyful and happy. Everyone would come and they were really, you know, this is a quality that they embodied. You know, so clearly it was not a happiness that was based on, you know, having Rolls Royces or, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, whatever, you know, or, you know, luscious, you know, wonderful cornucopia of food. They accepted whatever food was given to them. And yet, you could just see from them that they were genuinely happy. So it was not a happiness that was based on getting things. It was not a happiness of being even in a happy marriage, because obviously they weren't, you know, married or in relationships. You know, and yet there was this happiness. So their joy and their happiness was the happiness of letting go, of renunciation, letting go of clinging, letting go of aversion. You could see it as the happiness or the joy of letting go of addiction. You know, letting go of that quality of being really, really contracted, of clinging to anything, or really caught up in hatred. We know how that feels. You know, if we're addicted or we're obsessed or we're really caught up in anger or hatred or these qualities, we're really consumed by them. We even use this language, don't we? Oh, he was consumed by hatred, you know, or he was, red hot with anger. You know, the images we use capture the ways in which they're not pleasant qualities, are they? We're burning with hatred or burning with desire. You know, is that what we really want? There may be some fun and some excitement in those things, but it's not the deepest kind of happiness, you know, that the Buddha is pointing to. It's really, and when we experience genuine joy and genuine happiness, it's not dependent on having something or getting rid of anything. And as we've spoken about, we can cultivate joy and happiness by inclining our minds towards the good, towards what will make us, you know, what will increase our happiness and our well-being. And it's important to note, we're not talking about wishful thinking. We're not talking about because we think something, therefore it's going to happen, you know. But rather a training of our minds to take in the good, which is available to us at any time, even in the most difficult times. And when we're cultivating the good, what we're doing is we're not just allowing our minds to default towards what's negative, which we can easily do, and I'll speak about that in a minute. I spoke in the last couple of classes, I mentioned a teaching of the Buddha, a quote from the Buddha where he says, whatever we frequently think and ponder upon, that will become the inclination of the mind. Whatever we frequently think and ponder upon, that will become the inclination of the mind. So if we think about and fixate on, you know, our anger or outrage, or then that's what's going to be the quality of mind that we're developing. And if we incline our mind towards happiness, towards joy, that's what's going to become the quality of our hearts and our minds. There's a well-known statement, epigram, or, you know, kind of nice statement. It's been attributed to many people, I think, including the Buddha. It goes, sow a thought, reap an act. Sow an act, reap a habit. Sow a habit, reap a character. Sow a character, reap a destiny. So what we're doing is, if we sow a thought, then we incline our mind towards thinking in a particular way. Then what will come out of that is acts. And when we keep doing those acts, we keep repeating them, you know, the patterns get established in the brain and they become habits. And the more we go down those pathways, the more likely we are to go down them in the future. There's a kind of a resonance that happens when we do something once, it makes it more likely that we'll do it again. And if we do something 100 times, it becomes very difficult not to do it the 101st time, because the energy that's pulling us, we've got these pathways, these neurons in the brain, these that are firing. And it feels like, yes, it feels pleasant to go down that pathway. It feels difficult not to go down that pathway. So it's really important where we place our attention, what we think about, what we ponder on. Obviously, what we watch on TV, what we look at on the internet. You know, this is what's going to affect us. You know, it's going to color our the qualities of our hearts and minds.
Isn't that key point that you're
And the question really, isn't it important to be aware of that moment where we could go down and we also have an opportunity to choose something different? In order to be able to do that, though, we have to be present. We have to be aware. We have to be mindful. That's why mindfulness is so crucial. Because if we're not mindful, there's nothing else really we will be able to do but go down that ladder, you know? Because without awareness, we're just going to keep going whoosh, whoosh, whoosh down that pathway or whatever image we want to use. We're going to keep firing in that direction, and that's where the action is going to go, where the thoughts are going to go. So in that moment, we have a choice. But we have to be mindful to be aware, oh, okay, there's the feeling, but before it, you know, in the Buddhist language, the contact with, you know, a pleasant experience, let's say, will lead us to the feeling of, oh, I want that. But if we can just be aware of the feeling before it gets to the clinging, then we can make another choice. We can say, I can stay with, you know, it might be if you have some, you know, wanting, you know, it might be a strong desire for something. Maybe it's something unhealthy. If we can be aware of that, that the feeling before it turns into grasping and clinging, then we have a choice. But once we've gone there, then, you know, it's more a learning afterwards, how could I have done it a different way? But if we can be aware and we can stay with the difficulty, we can stay with the unpleasantness, then we can learn, oh yes, I don't need to do that. I don't need to go in the habitual direction. I can actually choose something different in this situation. So what I want to talk about for a few minutes is the understandings that have come, particularly in the last few years in neuroscience, that very much reinforce the teachings that the Buddha was giving 2,500 years ago. You know, there's a great convergence of this kind of understanding. And there's a great book that some of you may be familiar with by Rick Hansen called Buddha's Brain. And he speaks about, really about this convergence. It's called Buddha's Brain, The Practical Neuroscience of Happiness, Love, and Wisdom. And if you haven't read this, I really recommend it. I enjoyed it, read it a number of times, a few times. But so I'll just kind of say some of the things that he's pointing to in his book and the study, mainly in neuroscience, about how the brain works and how understanding of how the brain works has tended to really reinforce these ancient wisdom teachings, you know, particularly about how we, how our brains work, how our minds work. One of the things that we've found, or has been found, is that our minds tend toward the negative. The way Rick Hansen puts it, and Richard Mendius, his co-author, he says negative experiences had more impact on our species' survival than positive ones. So we're primed to focus on and remember the negative more than the positive. Here's how he puts it. He says, imagine our mammalian ancestors dodging dinosaurs in a worldwide Jurassic Park 70 million years ago, constantly looking over their shoulders, alert to the slightest crackle of brush, ready to freeze or bolt or attack depending on the situation. The quick and the dead. If they missed out on a carrot, a chance at food or mating perhaps, they usually had other opportunities later. But if they failed to duck a stick, so a carrot or a stick, if they failed to duck a stick like a predator, then they'd probably be killed with no chance at any carrots in the future. The ones that lived to pass on their genes paid a lot of attention to negative experiences. So it's a kind of a nice image of, you know, our ancestors. It paid to be much more primed to be fearful of the negative than to be ready to take advantage of the positive. We needed to do both, but we could probably survive if we went a day or half a day or 2 days without a meal. But if we weren't careful to avoid what was fearful and threatening to our lives, then we wouldn't be around to pass on our genes to our ancestors, and we might not be around today. So we come from successful ancestors going back millions and millions of years who were really careful to avoid things that threaten their survival. So what he's pointing to is that we tend to be primed for the negative much more than ready to cultivate the positive. So here's some interesting things. The brain typically detects negative information faster than positive information. The brain is drawn to bad news. The image he uses is the brain is like Velcro for the negative experiences and Teflon for positive ones. So Velcro for the negative, like we stick to the negative, and Teflon for the positive, like, you know, the positive, like the little bubbles of water when you put it on a hot pan. They kind of just go, hit the surface and then bounce off. Easily they bounce off. So some of the examples of this are that it's easy to acquire feelings of learned helplessness from a few failures, but hard to undo those feelings, even with many successes. So we easily learn, oh, this is never going to work. I could never do this. You know, I'm not going to be any good. From just a few experiences of people maybe telling us, oh, you're no good. I remember I was told when I was young that I couldn't sing. It was probably true. But I never really gave it a chance to learn that. There was probably things I could have learned. I remember things, and when I was a child, I was in the Boy Scouts or the youthful version of that. And for some reason, there was this badge you could win if you could throw a cricket ball, the equivalent of a baseball, 30 feet. And for some reason, I told myself I could never do this. I didn't even give myself the chance to try to see how far, oh, I can't do that. Isn't it funny? I mean, it probably came from somebody saying, oh, you'll never be able to do that. Or perhaps convincing myself from some earlier experience, I can't do this. So easy to convince ourselves, I can't do this. So he's saying the learned helplessness is really easy to acquire, even from a few failures. But we might have many successes, and it's still quite hard to override that sense. You know, so in lots of these examples, it's like the negative gets easily embedded in us, and the positive is much harder to cultivate. Another one, people will do more to avoid a loss than to acquire a comparable gain. People will do more to avoid a loss. Kind of, there's more fear of loss than the benefit of an equal gain. You know, what we would do to, you know, to avoid losing $20 wouldn't be the same as gaining $20. It's not an even thing. We're more fearful on this side. Here's one that we might find obvious. Negative information about a person carries more weight than positive information. You know, you say something, you know, if somebody, you know, think about it in a newspaper, if, you know, you hear that somebody is, you know, is a fraud, you know, it's very hard to get that out of your mind if that, you know, if somebody says to you, oh, you know, be careful about that person, very easy to embed that notion that, you know, they're a bad person or they're a crooked person or they're not an untrustworthy person. You know, you might say 10 times about people, you know, that, oh, there's a really good person, but that tends to take more for that to become embedded in our awareness. I remember, this is an interesting one, I taught some classes at the Smithsonian, and they do an evaluation at the end. And you know, there might be like 80 or 90 or 100 people in the class, and I would read these evaluations, and maybe, you know, 45 out of 50 were positive and some were kind of more neutral. But all it would need would be one or two to say, you know, ah, awful. And you think that would be the one where the mind would focus on, you know, that would be like, why did they think that? What did I do wrong? You know, all of that. And, you know, the 40, you know, however many it was, would kind of like, oh, yeah, okay, you know. It's like the mind kind of focuses in on those things. This is one that may resonate and may not be surprising. In relationships, it typically takes about 5 positive interactions to overcome the effects of a single negative one. You know, you can imagine you're in, you know, maybe you're in a relationship and a partner says, you know, says something negative, and how that can really stick with us. Whereas, you know, they could say, you know, 4 or 5 very positive things, and you know, kind of like it you know, comes off us like water off a duck's back. So one of the things that, you know, based on this, and many more things could be said to reinforce this point, that we tend to gravitate towards the negative, that the mind tends to be like Velcro for negative experiences. They tend to stick with us. But it doesn't work in the same way for the positive. So we really need to cultivate the positive. We really need to, one way of putting it, we really need to take in the good. We really need to allow ourselves to feel positive experiences. What the Buddha talked about is cultivating the good, abandoning the unskillful by opening to our experience, and consciously cultivating the good. So the neuroscience is really saying the same as the Buddha said in this very pithy statement 2,500 years ago, abandon what's unskillful and cultivate the good. That we really need to cultivate these qualities of the Brahma-viharas and the awakening factors that I spoke about, these 7 qualities I spoke about earlier. And here are some ways that we can do this. We can actively look for the positive around us. We can turn positive facts into positive experiences. You know, if somebody says something positive to us, you know, that was a really good piece of work you did today. You know, our tendency is just to kind of let that go. And what the neuroscience is telling us, and what the Buddha's teachings are also have long time been saying, is allow yourself to feel that. Allow yourself to experience it. Stay with the positive feelings. You know, stay with them for 5 or 10 or 15 or 30 seconds. Let yourself feel them. Feel the sensations in your body, in the heart area. Maybe there's some warmth in your chest, a feeling of happiness. If you can, just allow that feeling to, allow yourself to take in that feeling. That was a really kind thing you did, you know. Or you know, it was a really good, really good paper you wrote. Or you're really looking good today, you know. Just allow yourself to, you're looking really well, looking really healthy. You know, allow yourself to take that in and feel it. A lot of sirens tonight, don't they? Yeah. They're a good mindfulness bell. Oh, hear the sound. So we can take in those positive feelings, really allow ourselves to feel them, let them permeate our body, our feelings, our heart. You might even visualize these feelings of contentment or joy or ease or happiness. Allow them to visualize them filling your body. You might imagine that these are like the sun coming in and warming you. You know, just letting the rays of good feelings come in and allowing yourself to experience them. When we cultivate the positive in these ways, we're in fact changing the structure of our brains. And that's really one of the understandings that we're coming to now, that we're changing our brains through this cultivation, through where we're paying up, what we're paying attention to, allowing ourselves to feel kind of the kind of the sensory experience and the visualization, the feeling. In that process, we're transforming our brains. We're creating new and healthier neural pathways in the brain. What Rick Hansen says is, when you tilt towards the positive, you're actually writing a neurological imbalance. So to think about it as a neurological imbalance, this gravitating towards the negative. It's obviously really good that we can do this, that we have the ability to be able to be fearful and ready to fight or flee when we need to, or freeze when we need to. You know, we wouldn't pass on our genes if we weren't able to do that, if we weren't able to jump out of the way of a bus that's coming or a car that's coming towards us, or a wild animal that's coming towards us, or anything that's really threatening. We need to be able to do that. But it's not so helpful when we go into that fight or flight mode and stick with that in situations where that's not called for. You know, the example I often use is, you know, if you're at work and your boss says to you, I need that report by Monday, you know, Friday afternoon. You know, I need that report by Monday. You know, it's quite natural that we'll go into that fight or flight place, but it's not a healthy thing to stay in that place. We get really stressed out when we do, when we go back to, you know, never going to be able to do it. Oh, you know, then what's going to go wrong and what's going to go wrong? So to stay in that negative place isn't a healthy thing. So to know that we can, that we have the ability to respond, to get the adrenaline going when we need to, you know, good to get the adrenaline going to write the paper or do what we need to do, but not to stay, you know, focused and fixated in that way. So this cultivation of the positive, of the good, is really getting the mind, getting the brain back into balance in a healthy way. So we're creating a more healthy brain, healthy way of responding to our experience. So it's important too to bring mindfulness to our tendency to identify with negative stories about ourselves, about our experience, about our life. You know, to see when we're getting into, when we're getting stuck in a story about, you know, this isn't going to work, or they're always going to be like this, or I'm never going to be able to make it in this job, or I'll never get out of this rut, or life is always going to be like this. You know, you might think to yourself, might reflect for a moment, is there a story that you tend to identify with about your experience or about your life? I know for me, I can easily get into a story of it's too much. You know, I've got too much to do. Maybe others here have that. You know, get into a place of contraction about it. And it's a fear story. It's a story of fear, and they tend to be fear stories. Anxiety, worry, fear, kind of same kind of constellation of emotions. And if we're identified with that story, then it really can color everything. And it doesn't allow the space for joy to arise. When we're stuck in that story, stuck in that place, then there's no space for joy, for happiness. We get into this a story of a separate self. We're separate from others. We're separate from life. We're in a very defensive place. You know, because we're identified with this limiting belief about how things are or how we are. And so to be able to see that, in order to cultivate joy, we really, one thing is to take in the good, cultivate the positive. The other thing is to see where we're stuck in a negative story, a negative belief, where we're caught up in contraction, but particularly in that belief about how things are. So we can work with these stories, with these negative stories. One way is just by opening to them and seeing, oh, that's a thought. I don't have to identify with that. That's a belief. I could let it come and let it go. But if they're strong and long-standing stories, it may not be enough just to say, oh, hi, there you are, you know, and let them go. That can be helpful, but it may not be enough. Also very important to come into what's underneath them. Is there a contraction in the mind? Is there a strong emotion? Can I allow myself to feel all that open? You know, to use the acronym RAIN, you know, recognizing, allowing, investigating with kindness, and not identifying. You know, letting it all come, letting it be, letting it stay for as long as it wants to, welcoming the guests, letting them pass. It may be helpful to interrogate that belief. Is it really true, what I'm telling myself? You know, this story, this belief that I'm stuck in, is this really the truth? You know, not to get into a big back and forth about it, because then we can get caught up in analysis and discursive thought, but really to say, is this really true? Is this true? And then, too, we can incline our minds to the positive. You know, as we did at the beginning, come back to, how is it in this moment if I'm not in this story? Can I be happy? Can I be joyful right now? You know, happy in the present moment. Einstein said, there are two ways to live your life. One is as though nothing is a miracle. The other is as though everything is a miracle. You can live your life as though nothing is a miracle. The other is as though everything is a miracle. And Albert Camus said, in the middle of winter, I at last discovered that there was in me an invincible summer. In the middle of winter, I at last discovered that there was in me an invincible summer. So I want to finish off with a few words, because what I've been talking about is how we need to cultivate joy, what gets in the way of cultivating joy, how we can be stuck in the negative and we can be stuck in, particularly in negative stories about the way things are. And it's really important that we cultivate joy in our own lives, because if we don't, it's very, very difficult to be able to bring appreciative joy or sympathetic joy to anybody else. To find joy in the happiness of another if we're not able to know what joy feels like. So cultivating joy is really essential. And the more that we can do this, the more we cultivate joy, the more the sense of separation breaks down. Because necessarily, if we're experiencing joy, we're not caught up in separation. Because when we're caught up in separation, there's no room for joy. And when we're really experiencing joy, there's no room for separation. You know, and when I'm talking about joy, I'm not talking about, you know, a limited kind of happiness. I'm talking about genuine joy, which means really connection, non-separation. And when I can experience that, naturally what flows outward is appreciation of the joy, you know, joy in the happiness of others. There's not a sense of separation. There's not a kind of, well, there's only a limited amount of happiness to go round, and if you have it, then I won't have it. You know, that's an easy thing to go, a place to go to when we're in a place of separation. When we're in a place of fear, then, you know, how could I be happy in your happiness? Because I don't feel happy myself. I feel in this separate place. But if I'm feeling joyful, if I can experience and know joy, then naturally I experience, it's not a limited thing. You know, it's not like there's some limited quantity of happiness to go around. And if, you know, you have three quantums of it and you have four, then, oh, is there enough? You know, it's not. There's more than enough joy for all of us to go around, because it isn't that a limited kind of resource in that way. I said at the beginning that this is traditionally seen as the most difficult of the Brahma-viharas to cultivate. Because of these tendencies to see things in this limited way. When we're in a place of contraction, it's really hard to be happy in another person's happiness. You know, and any sense of separation will separate us from the happiness of others, you know, or will limit that. So it's hard to get to that place. We have to open in order to be able to connect with the happiness of others. But we can do that. And when we do cultivate happiness in the happiness, in the joy of others, it can neutralize these afflictive qualities, these qualities of separation, of greed, of anger, and aversion. So what I'm... we come to time. Actually, we've gone a couple of minutes over. I apologize for that. But what I didn't give out a handout tonight, but we will send it out tonight. And the invitation this week is to bring the cultivation of gratitude and joy into your practice. And what I've done is I've given you some talks on mudita, on appreciative joy and joy more broadly, and some guided meditations, and the chapter in Sharon Salzberg's book, and the meditations in Jack Kornfield's Art of Forgiveness, Loving Kindness, and Peace. And I really encourage you this week to explore the cultivation of the good, of what's positive in your own lives, in your own experience, both in meditation and in daily life. How does it feel when we really take in the good? When we really just appreciate, you know, if we're out on a walk, you know, just the sun in, you know, the sun on our skin and the wind in our face, or the beautiful tree or a flower or somebody's smile, and really take that in, allow ourselves to feel that and experience that. How does that change anything? How does that affect us when we do that? So we'll send those that out tonight, and I hope you have a great week, a good week of practice, a good week of taking in the good, cultivating the good and joyful. And I look forward to seeing you next week for the final class, where I'll say a few more words about joy, and then we'll finish off by talking about this wonderful quality of equanimity, of this balanced quality of heart and mind, upekkha in Pali. Have a great week.